hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Throughout this series, we've been exploring many different historical perspectives about the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution. From founding fathers to French Canadians, and from Baptists to buggerers, we've covered a lot of ground. Over the past month or so, we've also focused a great deal on the tensions between the ideals expressed in the Declaration, that all men are created equal, and the realities of the era. For example, Native Americans are described as merciless savages in the Declaration. Were Indians created equal? Furthermore, that famous passage criticizing slavery as violating the sacred rights of life and liberty was deleted from the final draft of the Declaration. So, were Africans created equal? And we recently looked at homosexuality in the colonies. Were all men, including gay men, created equal? There is yet another group who also experienced the tension between the ideals of the Declaration and its reality, a group whom we have unfortunately barely discussed. Of course, I'm talking about women. I think it's fair to say that American women have felt the tensions in the Declaration as much as anyone else. In fact, those opening words you heard, the explicit statement that all men and women are created equal, were from the first Women's Rights Convention in the U.S., the Seneca Falls Convention. Seneca Falls was in 1848, which was nearly 75 years after the Declaration of Independence. And don't forget that the full women's suffrage was not guaranteed until the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was passed in 1920, almost 150 years after the nation's founding. In short, women have often been marginalized in the American Revolutionary narrative, and besides Betsy Ross, Abigail Adams, and Sally Hemings, they've remained practically invisible. So today we're going to take a deep dive into the subject of revolutionary women with my eminent guest, Professor Rosemarie Zaghari. Welcome, Rosemarie.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Rosemarie is Distinguished Professor of History at George Mason University. She has published widely on women in the American Revolution, including the book Revolutionary Backlash, Women and Politics in the Early American Republic, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Links are in the show notes. So, Rosemarie, why don't you get us started? How do you start telling the story of women and the American Revolution?
Okay, well, I think that by looking backward from Seneca Falls, we see the unfolding of the consequences of the revolutionary movement and the expansion of the idea of equality and natural rights to a group that had been marginalized, dispossessed, ignored, and overlooked, that is women. But I think it's more appropriate, actually, to start with the status of women before the American Revolution, to understand what changed with the revolution and set in motion the series of events that made the Seneca Falls Proclamation possible 75 years after the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it's fair to say, and it's absolutely irrefutable, that the framers of the Declaration of Independence were not anticipating that their document was meant to include women, white women, black women, enslaved women. But the principles embedded in the Declaration of Independence, especially equality and natural rights, were the ones that women were able to seize upon, take upon, and to develop in the years subsequent to the American Revolution, even during the Revolution, frankly, and apply to their status, and then to begin to demand political, social, and economic rights. So to go back to the status of women before the American Revolution, I think it's really important to understand that basically in Anglo-America, in England and America of the mid-18th century, women were politically invisible. They had virtually no political or legal standing. They were not regarded as subhuman by any means. For some purposes, they had rights as subjects of the crown. They could, for example, petition their colonial legislatures or join in petitions to parliament, but they had very few of what we would consider political and legal rights. And this was true both in Britain and in America. Part of that is because of a tradition in British history that's called coverture. And under coverture, married women were considered to be legally subsumed under their husband. So married women could not make contracts, sue and be, or be sued in court, testify in court. Of course, they could not vote or hold public office. So they were, for most purposes, legally negligible. Now, I should say that single women, unmarried women, or widows had some limited forms of property rights. If a woman inherited property from her father, wealth from her father, either in terms of slaves or money or land, she could own them until she got married. If a widow, her husband died and she was left with any kinds of property, she could also exercise property rights basically in place of her deceased husband. But those rights all went away once a woman married, and the vast majority of adult white women in colonial America, in revolutionary America, were married and thus were deprived of rights. There were also a lot of social prohibitions regarding women, prohibitions preventing them from speaking in public to mixed groups of men and women. Certainly a sexual double standard that regarded women's sexual transgressions as much more heinous than anything done by men, including extramarital sex or illegitimate births. So you're dealing with a time in which, and we're talking about the 1750s, 60s, 70s, in which women had very little in the way of a public presence. But the coming of resistance to Great Britain and the American Revolution itself, with the debate over equality and natural rights, changed the debate about women and ultimately helped make possible some changes in women's legal and political status. Not very much in the short run, are there, although there were some changes, but much more in the longer run, as we're talking about with regard to the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848.
So basically, the argument is without the Declaration of Independence, it would be difficult for us to chart a path from whatever the Anglo-American legal state was for women to emancipation. In other words, I'm trying to see, like, is there a parallel track of history, like, say, in Britain itself? I mean, are we seeing kind of the same things, or is there a split?
I think what's important to emphasize here is that there's a transatlantic movement during the Enlightenment going on in France, Britain, Germany, and North America that is reevaluating the status of women, that is starting to talk about women's roles in society, and especially in terms of the quality of women's minds and the fact that women have the same intellectual potential and capacity for intellectual achievement as men. And so I do want to emphasize that that's a transatlantic movement that writers of the Enlightenment, the Western Enlightenment, were discussing even before the American Revolution. But the American Revolution and the participation of women, the invitation for women to participate, and women's actual participation greatly heightened the presence of women in public life, political life. It empowered women. It made male political leaders acknowledge the importance of women in political life. And then subsequently, the coming of the French Revolution in the 1790s greatly accelerated that focus on the role of women's roles and women's rights. And there is a very, very profound set of discussions that go on in France during the French Revolution and some changes to women's role and women's participation in politics. And all of this is being communicated across the Atlantic. So I want to emphasize that it's a transatlantic dialogue about women's rights that begins with the 18th century Enlightenment, accelerates with the coming of the American Revolution, and then takes off with the French Revolution.
Just one other point or question before I move on. When you started, you were talking about, well, you use some specific language of natural rights and then sort of one's rights in public, which we might call civil rights. So in the episode, our first episode on Jefferson, the historian mentioned that what we can and should probably read in that line, all men are created equal, that what Jefferson is trying to say is all people, men, women, black people as well, gay people maybe presumably too, have some sort of natural rights. What they don't have are equal civil rights, though. Would you agree with that general assessment or interpretation of that line?
I think that is among the things that gets to be very strongly debated during the American and French Revolutions. I think the Enlightenment introduces John Locke's idea of the tabula rasa, that all people, you know, have these natural rights. I think that idea of universal rights is being discussed. And I think the political revolutions of the 18th century, the American and French revolutions, highlight the question about who is included and who is excluded from the polity, who has civil or political rights and who does not. You see, in a certain way, being a subject of the king is a broader and more general and vaguer kind of status than being a citizen. And so once you start talking about universal rights and then political and civil rights, intellectuals, political leaders, men and women on both sides of the Atlantic started debating, you know, who should have the right to vote? Who should have the right to hold public office? And why are certain people included and why are certain people excluded? Why are they included just because they're men or white? And why are certain people enslaved? Okay, why are certain people such as Native Americans excluded from the social compact? Okay, so I think what's happening is that question of universal rights in combination with the political turmoil and political revolutions of the late 18th century focuses the issue on civil and political rights and who is included and who is excluded.
Okay, so we just gave a little general overview there. Let's move on to one of our first points here, which is how men tried to appeal to women to participate in pre-rebellious activity, we might say. So from previous episodes, we've learned about the Stamp Act and the Coercive Acts, the Boston Tea Party everyone knows about. But there was actually a movement by male political leaders to try to start in the very early stages of rebellion, pre-going to war and declaring independence, getting women more involved. Can you talk to us a little bit about that, please?
Yes. Well, the increasing incorporation of women into grassroots political protest was absolutely essential to the changes and the reevaluation of women's role that occurs during and after the revolution. So, as your listeners probably know, American colonists did not have representation in Parliament. And so in response to a series of laws passed by Parliament, beginning in the 1760s with the Stamp Act, the Townshend Acts, and later on the Coercive Acts in the 1770s, Americans struggled to respond. How could they put pressure on Parliament to repeal these hated laws, which they thought were unconstitutional and unjust, when they had no representatives? They had no elected representatives to make their case. They could make their case informally, and they did make their case through petitions, through resolutions, through appealing to members of Parliament who might be sympathetic, but they had no direct representation. And so they knew that if their resistance to these British policies was going to be effective, they had to turn to the people. And by the people, they meant a larger group of the population, unspecified, but ordinary people, men and women, sometimes even free black people, who could voice protests against these British policies and who would do this through their words and through their actions. And so some of the earliest ways in which women got involved were by participating in the boycotts, or the so-called non-importation agreements against Great Britain. So beginning with the Stamp Act, the leaders of the colonies gathered in the so-called Stamp Act Congress and passed a resolution calling on colonists to boycott the purchase of British goods, to not buy goods from Great Britain. And since the North American British colonies were the major outlet for goods shipped on British ships and produced in Great Britain, this was an attempt to strike an economic blow, to put economic pressure on Great Britain. Now, what male political leaders quickly discovered is that they needed women, they realized that they needed women, if this effort was going to be successful. And so what we see, and I mean, it's really remarkable to see, is that in all sorts of publications, in newspapers, in posters or broadsides that would be put up in localities, in essays, male political leaders started writing to a female audience, appealing to a female audience, and asking women to support these boycotts against Great Britain, to not purchase the kinds of British goods that women loved, including things like lace and feathers and fabrics, and most especially tea that would be, of course, grown in Asia, but shipped on British ships. And so white male political leaders in the colonies knew that for their boycotts to be successful, women would need to buy into this idea. They would need, as the purchasers of their family's goods, to join in these boycotts. And in the process, they were then incorporated as patriots. They were called patriots. They were incorporated into the protest movements. They were acknowledged to be important players in this movement to resist Great Britain's unjust and what were eventually called tyrannical actions against the colonies. And what we know from a variety of sources, from newspapers, from correspondence, private correspondence, and even from some publications from women themselves, is that women rallied to support this patriot cause, to the cause of resistance. We know that it was particularly white middle and upper class women, but in towns and cities throughout the North American British colonies, women joined with one another in sewing circles to make fabric, to sew clothes. They called it homespun fabric. And they proudly wore these homespun materials as a sign of their support for the resistance against Great Britain. they signed agreements with one another. And I mean, I want to emphasize, too, that there was a high rate of literacy in the North American British colonies, but even a high rate of literacy among white women. And they signed agreements among one another, promising, pledging to one another that they would not buy British goods. Some of these women even called themselves the Daughters of Liberty as an analog to the male Sons of Liberty. And so women, and of course, you know, people would like to know numbers. We don't really have good figures, but we have enough evidence from a wide variety of contemporary sources that indicate that women throughout the colonies, from New Hampshire to South Carolina, felt themselves empowered by this call to join in the resistance movement and rallied and started to consider themselves members of the resistance and, in the wake of that, patriots and then citizens of this emerging new nation.
Fascinating, Rosemary. Two follow-up questions here. One, I'm interested in the connection between religion and female literacy. Obviously, the Protestant prerogative that one ought to be able to read the Bible himself and also herself, presumably, means that literacy is something that through a religious belief then spans both genders. And so we're seeing a religious connection there too. So we would presume that French women and or French Canadians would be less literate because of the Catholicism.
I don't know literacy rates among French Canadians. I do know that in the Western world, the North American colonies had the highest rate of literacy, followed by Great Britain, followed by France. So in the North American British colonies, the northern colonies, the Protestant New England, formerly Puritan colonies, had the highest rates of literacy. And these are very squishy numbers, but it's believed that up to 80% of all adult white men in the northern colonies could read, and 50 to 60% of adult white women. In the southern colonies, the levels were much lower, partly because Anglicanism rather than Puritanism or Calvinism was pervasive. And so the numbers, and this is really just a guess, but you would have that. So maybe 20 to 30% of all adult white women could read, and 40 to 50% of all adult white men in the South. But still, those numbers are comparable or higher to the highest rates in Western Europe at that time.
Were there any specific religious arguments directed towards women in their involvement?
Well, that's an interesting point. Not sectarian, or not, you know, in particularly specific to any particular religious group, but more generally, that women were the vessels of virtue and women were the upholders of morality, and not just private virtue, but the upholders of civic virtue. And that through their participation in these political movements, they were translating their private virtue into a broader canvas, into a broader playing field. And also within the home, it's now being encouraged that women know about political matters and know about Republican government once you get past independence, and inculcate these ideas of Republican virtue and participation in government and sacrifice for the Republic in their sons and husbands. And really, women are seen as really being essential to the circuit of the conveyance of the connection between public and private virtue in the society.
Fascinating. Final question on the subject. You mentioned that articles were being written in newspapers directed at women. So I'm thinking, were there women-specific publications, like women's magazines, The Revolutionary Woman?
Yes. Well, that's a very good question. There were women's magazines in England at this time, but they weren't the ones promoting independence. Women's magazines were not widely published in the United States until after the Revolution. But you do see in newspapers, you see sections to the ladies or poetry to the ladies. And you have pamphlets published. And you even begin to see the emergence of some female authors. And at the time, a lot of these women wrote anonymously, but a lot of male authors also wrote anonymously, I should say. But we know, and we know subsequently that they were female authors, and even among small groups of people at the time, it was known that women were writing in support of the cause of resistance and revolution. And one of the ones that we know most about today is a woman named Mercy Otis Warren, who was from Massachusetts. And she wrote poetry and satirical plays, propaganda really, in support of the Boston Tea Party, in support of the boycotts against Great Britain. She wrote these plays attacking the British officials in Massachusetts. And some of these were published in newspapers. Some of them were published as standalone pamphlets. And I should emphasize that this is also both an oral and a written society. So these plays, for example, were not meant to be performed, but were read aloud in parlors and in taverns throughout the colonies. And so there was a real connection between what was being written and what was being heard by larger numbers of people. And this was true for both men and women, but women were among these authors. And I should also mention the female author who also happened to be Black, Phyllis Wheatley. And Phyllis Wheatley was an enslaved woman who came to North America and lived with a family in Boston at a very young age, around age 7 or 8, from Africa. But it was clear to her family, the Wheatley family, a merchant family in Boston, that from a very young age, Phyllis, as they called her after the ship on which she was transported to America, was very precocious, and she was a domestic house servant, not by any means a field hand, and they educated her. And they educated her, and she learned to read not just English, but in Greek and Latin. And she became accomplished, and at a very young age, as a teenager, they actually helped her publish some poems in newspapers. And you were asking about religion. One of her early poems was about the English itinerant preacher, George Whitefield, the great evangelical. So she was very devout, very religious. But in the lead up to the American Revolution, she started writing poems to American political, military, and political leaders, including George Washington. And in those poems, she identified with the revolutionary cause. She saw herself as one of the inhabitants of North America being protected from British tyranny by this looming revolt against Great Britain. And so I think it's fascinating that women, even though they were not enfranchised, even though they had no formal political rights at this time, felt the effect of revolutionary ideals and revolutionary rhetoric and started to apply it to themselves. And those who could started to write. And because the cause was considered to be the cause of all Americans, however you want to define that, male political leaders were only very happy to have such publications printed in newspapers and pamphlets and disseminated around the colonies because they did help encourage revolutionary fervor. They did help promote resistance against Great Britain. But I guess I want to emphasize that, you know, whatever the intentions of the male political leaders, that is women, white and to a limited extent Black women, applied those ideals to themselves. And we have other instances of this, women applying this revolutionary rhetoric to themselves.
Before we move on to others, just a quick couple of questions here. Were they writing largely under their own names, or were they forced to take male pseudonyms?
Yes. Mercy Otis Warren of Massachusetts largely wrote either anonymously or under a pseudonym. But again, a lot of male authors at this time did so as well. But within Massachusetts, she was friends with John and Abigail Adams, and Adams was one of her greatest promoters, and he encouraged her to write and publish and helped make that possible. Phyllis Wheatley actually published under her own name. It's a remarkable story, actually. The Wheatley family paid for her to go to Britain, and their aristocratic woman, evangelical woman, paid for Phyllis Wheatley's poems to be published. And then Wheatley could have stayed there, and under English law at this time, after the Somerset case, would have been free. But she returned to the colonies, and is believed that the Wheatley family then freed her. And this would have been right either on the eve of the Revolution or at the very beginning of the Revolution. But she actually published under her own name. She actually sent that poem that she wrote about George Washington in a letter to George Washington. Washington read the letter, and he invited her to meet with him to discuss her poem, to praise her, to celebrate her contribution. And he had that poem published as well. So it's a mixed bag. I think largely, though, women who published at this time did so under pseudonyms or anonymously. But I will also emphasize that a lot of women wrote about these revolutionary principles and issues privately in their own correspondence as well.
One of the reasons I asked this is you've been making this argument that I'm kind of hearing is that women are actively writing themselves into the definition of what it means to be an American citizen. They're saying we are the people too. So I was just curious, you know, as they're adopting pseudonyms, are they adopting like female pseudonyms? Are they trying to say we are women writing ourselves into the revolutionary narrative? You cannot think of the people, we the people, without thinking of us.
No, that would not have been the stance that they took at that time. No. If anything, they would have adopted more generic Latin kinds of pseudonyms referring to ancient Greece or Roman republicans. So you have women that we know now writing among themselves who are claiming a stake in this revolution for themselves, who are claiming citizenship, if you will. And so you have the case of Richard Henry Lee's widowed sister in Virginia. Richard Henry Lee, of course, was the one to, you know, propose the resolution for independence. But she's back in Virginia, and she writes to him and says, "Hey, I'm a widow. I pay taxes. I thought this revolution was about no taxation without representation. Why do I not have a vote?" And when he receives this letter, he's utterly flabbergasted. He just can't believe it. And he blubbers something about, well, women wouldn't really want to vote anyway. You have to go out in public. You have to go to these taverns where there's a lot of drunken men. And it's really not a problem. But it was truly a shock for him because it hadn't even occurred to him. But she took that principle of no taxation without representation and applied it to herself and said, I am being excluded. An example that's more famous today is the case of Abigail Adams, John Adams' wife, who's back in Massachusetts while he's in Philadelphia working on the Declaration of Independence. And she writes this letter where she says, as you are making laws for the new nation, she does this in the spring of 1776, remember the ladies. And in that letter, she says, all men would be tyrants if they could. She says, all men would be tyrants if they could. Now, she doesn't go so far as to demand a vote or any specific political rights. But in that letter, it is crystal clear that she is taking the revolutionary rhetoric about George III being a tyrant, being the super patriarch of the empire, and applying it to the condition of women within their own families, the condition of wives relative to their husbands. And she's saying that within families, men are often tyrannical, and you need to remember to protect women and to make laws for women in this new nation. So John Adams was clearly flabbergasted to get this letter from his wife. He had never even considered the possibility that women might apply the rhetoric of equality or rights to themselves, to the idea that there could be tyrants oppressing them in their status as wives. And he writes back a very flippant letter to his wife, where he talks about, well, you know, we can't expand women's rights because we know that women already have the greatest amount of power. Men are already subject to the despotism of the petticoat, he calls it. Men are subject to the despotism of the petticoat. Well, she's infuriated, and she actually writes to her friend, Mercy Otis Warren, and says, I think you should join me in writing a petition to Congress where we make the case about and for women. So I think even more than that first letter to John Adams and that letter to Mercy Otis Warren, where she says we should petition Congress, she is really saying that women's subjugated position can lead to a kind of political action that is a protest against women's lack of political and legal rights. Again, it's very inchoate at this time, but you see these ideas emerging. And I think that's what hadn't happened before. And I think it's these ideas that are embodied in the Declaration that were bandied about throughout the whole resistance movement and the revolutionary period about equality and natural rights that were then being applied to women, and women themselves took on a new sense of empowerment from that.
Great. What a wonderful description of how these individual women were trying to take the ideas that they're getting in the public square about political rights and then obviously making the natural leap in logic to say, wait, maybe I'm included too. Women were included in many ways. Maybe some were not participating in battle, but of course, what we know about all wars is that women make sacrifices in war, even if they're not fighting themselves. So could you maybe just talk about the experience of revolutionary women at home?
Yes. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that women have always, as you said, been asked to make sacrifices during war. But I think what's different here is that both men and women during the American Revolution started to acknowledge that women were making these sacrifices. And so in terms of what sacrifices, of course, they had to watch as their husbands and sons were sent off to war, as some of them were killed or wounded or came back, you know, maimed, all right? But while they were gone, while they were serving in the military or while they were serving in this new government that was being created, both at the state level and at the national level, men had to go off and serve in the government in new and demanding ways that they hadn't been asked to do before. And women were often left behind to take care of the home and family, and in the South, the slaves. And so this meant that women were taking on a lot of burdens that they didn't necessarily have before. They had to oversee the planting of the crops, the harvesting of the crops. They had to make sure that the labor needs of their business or of their farm were met. They had to raise the children on their own, discipline the children on their own. They had to make financial decisions. And they tried to do this, you know, in correspondence with their husband, but correspondence was very slow. So women were being asked to make a lot of decisions on their own. And this too was both terrifying and empowering for a lot of women. Also, we can't forget that this is a war being fought among civilians. And so when the war came to a certain locality, to Philadelphia or Boston or South Carolina, women were often caught in the midst of battle. And women suffered food shortages. They suffered the deprivations that resulted from having battles being fought in your neighborhood. They were in danger physically, and they had to protect their farms and families and property and their own lives. And a lot of times they were on their own doing this. And so this was again, something that was a challenge, but also in some ways empowering. I'm not going to say that all women enjoyed having this new role thrust upon them. They didn't. But in a certain sense, it did transform the range of possibilities that women saw for themselves, that women were capable of exercising these roles in the absence of their husbands. And as I mentioned before, this contribution, these sacrifices were acknowledged by both men and women. And we see this in poems and in plays and in essays, in newspapers and in speeches made at the time. So when there were celebrations on the 4th of July, orators, male orators, didn't just acknowledge the contributions of the men, of the soldiers or of the politicians or even of ordinary men who were on the home front, but the contributions of wives and mothers who suffered through the war and who held up the home front during the war and who made the revolution possible because it was being fought in their midst. And we also have more poignant cases of, there was an effort beginning in Philadelphia in 1780, led by a woman named Esther DeBert Reed. And she knew that the Continental Army always suffered from a shortage of supplies, of uniforms, of every kind of material that you could imagine. So she actually wrote a published document calling on the ladies of Philadelphia to go door to door to collect money in support of the troops. And this is actually a truly shocking proposition because proper ladies at this time did not go door to door and collect money. But she was herself upper class, and she mobilized some upper class white women, and they did collect thousands of dollars. And this campaign spread to some neighboring states from Pennsylvania to New Jersey, to Delaware, to Virginia. Martha Washington contributed money. Martha Jefferson also contributed money. And in Philadelphia, the women actually sat down and made shirts for the men of the Continental Army and embroidered their names in the shirts because they wanted men to know that the women were supporting them, that the women on the home front were behind them, and that women were making contributions in the ways that they could.
So what you've been talking about makes me think of this phrase that is used, this concept of Republican motherhood. So can you just give a brief overview of what this concept means, please?
Yes, the idea of Republican motherhood is a term that historians have coined, and it wasn't used at the time, but the concept was certainly there. And it was this concept that under this new form of government that was not a monarchy, that was based on the consent of the governed, based on citizen participation, it was necessary that all citizens participate in this government for it to be successful. And that included women. And women, it was understood, would make their contributions through their roles, their traditional roles as wives and mothers, but with this added political element, that they would raise the new citizens of the republic to be educated about voting, about their duties as citizens. They would encourage their husbands and sons to go off to war, to take up arms if necessary, to vote, to serve in public office. And so part of that concept of Republican motherhood, that in a republic you need an educated citizenry, was that women themselves should need to be more educated and should need to know about their government, about the operations of their government, and that they had a stake in the outcome because this was a government based on the people.
How much of this impulse is coming from women themselves, and how much is it coming from, say, like the patriarchy, this Republican motherhood impulse?
I think we have a lot more published writings, especially from people like Benjamin Rush, that explicitly discuss this concept. But I think it's very clear by reading women's private correspondence and then later essays published by women that they assume and take on this role and embrace this role. And then a woman who wrote during and after the revolution, Judith Sargent Murray, was one who really very explicitly embraced this role of what we call Republican motherhood and was a very strong proponent of educating women to be virtuous citizens of the Republic and to be the educated wives of male citizens and the sons and the husbands that would lead the Republic.
Okay. I mentioned at the very start of this talk that the full suffrage was not granted to women until 1920. But why don't you just tell us about the brief history of women voting in New Jersey, please? This might be one of the most direct consequences of the Declaration of Independence for women.
Yes, well, of declaring independence. Even before the Continental Congress voted on the resolution for independence, they sent out a missive to the colonial governments, to the provincial governments at the time, the acting governments. And this was in May of 1776. And they instructed the leaders in these states to write their first state constitutions. So each of the 13 states then undertook the job of crafting a new government. And in many cases, it was based on the structure loosely from their colonial charters. But in many cases, there were very substantial changes in the structure of government, especially in giving more power to the legislatures and diminishing the power of the executive. Also, at this time, it meant that each of the 13 now states, formerly colonies, could decide who could vote and who could hold public office. And so these varied widely, these qualifications varied widely from state to state. In New Jersey, alone among the states, they wrote a provision which said that all inhabitants who owned a certain amount of money, they called it proclamation money, were allowed to vote. In other words, there was a property qualification for voting. This was true in many of the other states. But by using that term, all inhabitants, it was what we would call gender neutral. And so it sort of opened the door for the possibility that people besides white males could vote. Now, in New Jersey, what happened was in the 1790s, the New Jersey legislature passed a series of laws regarding the franchise, regarding suffrage qualifications, in which they referred to voters as he and she. They referred to voters in 1790 and 1796 as he and she. And we know from poll lists that have been discovered by researchers at the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia and that are posted on their website that women actually did vote in New Jersey, definitely after 1790 and possibly between 1776 and 1790. And so it was no accident. It was no ambiguous interpretation of that clause, all inhabitants. But it was an extension of that principle that no taxation without representation. So if you are a widow, and remember, married women could not own property, but if you were a widow or a single woman who met the property qualification for voting in New Jersey, you were allowed to vote. And by the way, this also enfranchised free black people, men and women, who could meet that property qualification. And we know that small numbers of free black people did vote in New Jersey. Now, as you can imagine, that was very controversial at the time from the beginning. And from the beginning, there were attempts to repeal that clause and to disenfranchise these groups. And finally, in 1807, it was stipulated by law limiting the franchise to free white males.
Unfortunate.
I just want to say that that notion that states have control over their voting requirements was true, and that precedent of women voting in New Jersey became powerful in the post-Civil War era for the women's suffrage movement that was gaining ground then. It led to the first women's suffrage laws in the West, in Wyoming and Utah and places like that. And it gave credence to, legitimacy to, the claims of women who continued to advocate for women's suffrage into the 20th century. So it was a very important precedent, even though it did not result in the permanent enfranchisement of women, and it only pertained at that time to women in New Jersey.
Okay, so Rosemarie, we started by talking about that important line in the Seneca Falls Convention where we explicitly hear men and women are created equal. So why don't you end by just talking a little bit about how we get from the Declaration of Independence, where it just says all men are created equal, with the confusion in that, to the explicit he and she, which we see in New Jersey in the late 18th century, to then to Seneca Falls.
Okay, so I think the principles, the concepts embodied in the Declaration, equality and natural rights, gave birth to this larger public debate about the roles and rights of women in public and in political society. And even though there was no immediate movement for the mass enfranchisement of women, it ushered in a new era where women had a larger public and we would say political role. So in the early 19th century, you have a series of reform movements beginning with orphan societies, Bible movements, charitable organizations, groups to aid widows and orphans, then going on to the temperance movement and the anti-slavery movement. And women were deeply involved in all of those. And I think you see that process beginning with the greater incorporation of women into public life during the American Revolution. And I think by the time you get to the 1830s and 40s, women in these reform movements are frustrated because they see the limits of what they can do because they are not formally politically enfranchised. They see what they're doing as an extension of their roles as wives and mothers, but they see that they're also prohibited from holding office or from voting to advance these very important social changes like ending slavery. And so the birth of this one set of reform movements catalyzes women through their participation and leads them to understand how important political rights would be to women, and actually leads in the 1830s and then ultimately in the 1840s to the first women's rights movement and to the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848 and the issuance of that Seneca Falls Declaration, which so emphatically declares that all men and women are created equal.
Final question, Rosemarie. Here we are 250 years after the Declaration of Independence. How do you look at that phrase now, all men are created equal, as an American woman and a historian?
As promising hope and possibility. I think it's infinitely expandable, but I think it opens up conflict and contestation. And I think that we as Americans are so lucky to have those phrases embedded in one of our founding documents, so that later generations could debate and discuss their meaning and could see that their meaning should not be confined to a small group of white males, but could be expanded to larger and larger groups. First, white males without property, then black men, then white women, and now to larger and larger groups that the writers of those documents never imagined. So I regard those words in the Declaration as words of hope and possibility.
Professor Rosemarie Zaghari. Thank you very much.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.